Welcome to the Good Reading Podcast, proudly sponsored by Book People Gift Cards. A Book People gift card is the perfect gift for readers of all ages. Simply order your gift card online at bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au. Redeem at any one of over 500 bookshops across Australia. Visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.
He was staring into his plate of eggs at Jimmy's when she came in. Ben's hands were still shaking, had been all morning, but he couldn't figure out if it was last night's near miss under the jewellery store or the silence, as he'd come to think of it. The great big nothing at all that had happened since he'd left a handwritten letter on the windshield of a car belonging to a homicide detective from the South Bronx. 18 days, not a phone call, not an email, not a sound. A Ferris wheel of possibilities was turning in his head. Maybe the guy had figured it was a prank. Maybe the wind had swept the envelope off his car. Maybe his girlfriend and her kid going missing had fucked Ben's brain up so bad that he'd imagined the whole damn thing. He'd been so jacked walking there and placing the envelope under the windshield wiper that he barely remembered doing it. Maybe it was much worse than any of those things. Maybe Engo or Jake or Matt had followed him the day he left the letter. Maybe they'd taken it off the windshield, read it. Maybe they knew. His fork was doing Morse code on the edge of his plate. One of Jimmy's guys banged a fry basket into the hot oil, and the fork leapt clean out of Ben's hand. He looked at Jimmy's terrible, clumsy handwriting on the greasy whiteboards above the fry station and picked off items and tried to think about them instead. About salad, about burgers, about soup. Ben stared at his eggs. The woman had to say his name a couple of times before he heard her. Benjamin Haig?
Candace Fox is the author of 10 internationally best-selling crime novels and the winner of 3 prestigious Ned Kelly Awards, and the only author to have been shortlisted for that award for every single novel. Candace has also co-written 7 New York Times bestsellers with James Patterson, the world's best-selling author of crime thrillers. Today I'm talking to Candace Fox about her latest crime thriller, Devil's Kitchen. Candace, welcome to the Good Reading Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
New York feels like the ultimate setting for crime fiction, and your title, Devil's Kitchen, echoes the once legendary gritty neighbourhood of Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan's Midtown. Is that characteristic grit an essential ingredient in this particular brew?
Well, I hope so. It's certainly what I was going for. The whole Devil's Kitchen idea is a combination of the Devil's Arcade as well, which is what they called the Fabric District in New York back in the day when it was a cesspool of prostitution and crime and gambling. And yeah, I'm really hoping that readers see the underbelly of New York, and particularly their firefighting institution in this book. I'm really flipping the whole beautiful, glorious, sunshiny New York on its head in this book.
And so while that grit and the rough and uncompromising nature of Hell's Kitchen, and as you say, the Devil's Arcade, that all might be a thing of the past, but is its reputation enough for you to conclude that this is the right place for the setting of Devil's Kitchen?
Yeah, you know, as an author, you're always trying to undermine established stories and do something different. And I started with the concept of firefighters and their heroism, their inherent goodness, and the way that they're represented in books and media. I just wanted to really dig into that and flip it on its head, because the idea of the crooked cop is so established now that it's almost cliche. But you really don't see too many crooked firefighters. And I know that they're out there. And I know that for one reason, and it's because firefighters are people, and there are people who are bad. And so get enough of them together and you're going to, by sheer statistics, you're going to get bad ones. And I wanted to know what they were like. It was a dangerous idea. My publishers and my editors were nervous when I said New York firefighters being bad, because, you know, in the post 9/11 universe, They're the ultimate heroes. They made the ultimate sacrifice, and their trauma is the ultimate trauma. And to go needling in there and trying to play around with it, it could be seen as disrespectful. But you have to be bold and defiant, and as an author, you just have to do that. You have to write into those unwritten spaces, and that's what I was trying to do.
Bold is certainly the word. And at first, I thought that the idea of Engine 99, Fire and Rescue, was a rather audacious idea for a criminal gang. But it's that veil of respectability, the heroic, as you say, that perceived beyond reproach nature of the job can really just be a veil.
The first thing I started doing was talking to firefighters. I hadn't left home yet. I was here in Australia talking to firefighters, and I said to them, "Do you know bad firefighters? Are there bad firefighters?" And then invariably they said yes. And it didn't take long to find stories of firefighters who steal, firefighters who lie, firefighters who take advantage, or guys who light fires, or they enjoy that psychopathic sort of adrenaline junkie thrill of being in the middle of a fire. I mean, there's good reasons that people become police officers, and there's bad reasons that people become police officers. And those bad reasons are because they're after the power and the authority and the prestige and the violence. And the reason that bad people become firefighters is because they're after the adrenaline and the same thing, the power and that kind of thing. So yeah, it surprised me a little bit that it's an idea that hasn't really been done that much, because it's such a simple idea that there are bad people putting on these gleaming masks.
And as it turns out, it is the perfect cover for a whole range of sinister happenings. After all, fire is loud, as you write. What sort of cover does fire provide?
Well, it's a dangerous situation. The thing about fires and firefighters is that they create this scenario in which only the firefighters go in, because it's too dangerous for anyone else to go in. And so I started by hearing stories of firefighters who would go into bars and start pocketing bottles of top shelf whiskey, because they could just say, "Oh, hey, this whole shelf just collapsed," or firefighters going into drug dens and saying, "We need to be in there for another half an hour just to make sure the fire is out," and while there's stuff in their pockets with, drugs and weed and stuff. So it does create a perfect cover. So the first scene that you are a part of in this novel is you've got firefighters using a fire in a fabric store in order to mask their entry into the tunnel system that takes them underneath a jewelry store that they're robbing. They're doing it in plain sight. They've got an entire street's worth of civilians outside watching them do it.
We've got Matt, the hot-headed leader, Jake Valentine, perhaps the weak link, but who really knows? Engo or Engelman Fiss is a great name. His wife has been disappeared. And of course, Ben. And Ben is central to the idea of this book.
So I was trying to write about four different types of criminality, really. Their relationship is based on a group of guys that I had here at the house. I actually had a deck built at my house, and there was a crew of builders there, and you had this leader figure. He'd roll in like a storm, and the guys before he arrived would start saying, we'll call him Matt, there's no his real name, would say, "Matt's going to be here in 10 minutes. Everybody clean that up, go and do that." And he was one of these huge, tall, broad-shouldered, very powerful men, big man, big truck, big dog. He would go to all of his building sites and sort of supervise. Matt in the novel is a criminal because he's traumatized and because he thinks very badly of himself. And whereas Ingo is more your raging psychopath, possible serial killer who just oozes that mysterious, almost supernatural evil that we enjoy so much out of characters like Hannibal Lecter. Jake is the criminal because he's weak and easily led. And Ben is the more complex type who you really hopefully spend most of the novel trying to understand, because he seems to have a good heart and he seems to be disgusted by bad things. He seems to have a moral compass, and yet he is a criminal. And some of that feeds into his own self-worth and his upbringing and what he's trying to create. So there are four different types of criminals all working together in this perfect and imperfect system as a heist crew. And then you add Andy into the mix, and she's really the spanner in the works that eventually brings them all down.
We'll talk about Andy in a moment, but I just want to go back to that opening scene. Fire 99 are working on a jewelry store heist. It's an intensely claustrophobic scene with this palpable sense of panic. Of course, panic inevitably leads to unpredictable outcomes. And from the beginning in this book, there's issues of trust among the gang. Trust is the thing that might tear them apart.
There's nothing so boring to read about in a novel as a perfect team. And I think that that's where your superhero films, everyone talks about how the Marvel universe is just crumbling into a pile of ash. And I think that's because the teams get on so well. Everyone loves each other and there's lots of hugging and high-fiving and cheering. And so I wanted you to understand that this is a motley crew. This is a crew of people who really shouldn't be working together because they all are out for their own desires. And what I'm promising you when I'm giving you a heist novel is the promise that all good heist novels have, which is towards the end, there are going to be double crosses and triple crosses, and it's coming. And you just have to guess who's going to stab who in the back? You know, the first few pages of any novel are so critical. You have to hint that you will be giving this reader bang for their buck because everyone is shopping for their books these days on their own phone. And when they swipe away from your book, they have access to every other book that has ever existed. You are competing in a way as an author that you never have had to before. So in those first few pages, I'm trying to do a lot. I'm trying to make it exciting and claustrophobic. I'm trying to promise you that this is not going to be boring in terms of the human relationships that we're about to go into. I'm trying to promise you that this is a classic heist novel. If you picked up the book and you saw the word heist on it and that excited you, strap in because I'm going to give you what you're looking for. So, yeah, that opening scene does a lot of heavy lifting.
Into that den of intrigue and mistrust, you thrust Andy Neiland, a specialist. What kind of specialist is she?
She's not really working for anyone. She's a freelancer, a specialist, someone like a chimera, a chameleon, someone whose special skill is infiltrating situations and finding out. She sort of started doing that. I won't give it too much of the novel away, but she was doing that for her own ends. She infiltrated a situation so that she could have some answers about something that happened to her when she was a young person. And she was just good at it. She was good at adopting a whole new personality. It's something that I have to do as an author. I'm here in my room, with my laptop, and I'm by myself, and I am myself. But in my life, there are so many other selves, and I have to be that person who's on the stage, or I have to be that writer who's trying to encourage other writers, or I have to be a friend. You have to take on these different personalities. And Andy is just so good at that, at completely separating one identity from another. And it's kind of scary because Ben, when he recruits her to give him some answers, he really has no idea who he's dealing with. And his frustration after a while at really getting no hints about who she really is as a person, because he's in a heist crew, he's in a firefighting crew, all like you say, it's all about trust. He has to be able to hang on to just the tiniest little thread of trust at any given moment, and he has nothing to hang on with her. So you will be analyzing Andy very, very closely yourself, trying to figure out who she is as a person.
Yeah, she comes across as a fairly cold, maybe detached, calculating even, unemotional. There's a shower scene, which makes it pretty clear. It's on page 74. It shows that Neiland is quite dedicated to her job. We spoke about the grit before, but that scene takes the grit up a level.
Yeah. It's funny when you have a woman who is using sex in a book for anything other than romantic connection, people go, whoa, what is she doing? And Andy uses her body and sexual relations to achieve certain ends in her job. And that shocks Ben. And it probably will shock the reader that a woman would go so far as to do that. But I mean, there's a bit of sex in this book. I think that it's not all functional. That's up to you to decide whether some of these encounters are for her own self because she wants to, or if some of it is achieving certain aims.
With all of those things, you've got to wonder what motivates Andy Neiland.
Just obsessive person and good at what she does. A justice warrior, because it links back to her own childhood and what happened to her. And a distrust of the police, I suppose, because without giving too much away, she sort of became a lawmaker unto herself because no one was going to do it for her, clearly. So she's a woman who takes things into her own hands. I'm a bit like that myself. I'm one of those women who tries to do everything because I don't trust anyone else to do it.
All your other books, which frequently appear on the New York Times bestsellers list, but I wondered how New Yorkers themselves might react to the premise in Devil's Kitchen.
Well, I don't know yet, but I explained to these firefighters exactly what I was doing. It was really difficult trying to find guys who would talk to me because I went through from Australia, I went through all the official available channels to ask if I could come over and speak to them. And the answer was no. And I said, I'm going to have to go there and just try and find them. So I went to New York. I walked from fire station to fire station, bursting in on these guys and trying to get them to speak to me. And the first door that I had to get through was to say to them, hi, you walk in, you literally walk into the station, they're all standing there and they're doing their things and they're polishing things, working on things, doing paperwork, whatever. And you go, hi, my name's Candace. They all look around, ooh, and they hear the accent. What? Hi, my name's Candace. I'm hoping to speak to someone. I'm writing a book. I'm not a groupie. I'm not a journalist. I know that you're not allowed to speak to me officially, but I was hoping that you would. And it's a fictional book. And I'm not trying to stir up any 9/11 stuff. And if you just, if you just, if you just, and by this time they're like, what? No, whatever this is, no. Then I had to say to them, well, it's a fictional book about New York firefighters and all of the firefighters, the bad guys. I thought about not saying that part just so I could be past the first door and inside there for a little bit longer before I would go all the way through. But I didn't want these people to become invested in me and then feel betrayed. So my next thing that I would say is, yeah, and the firefighters are the villains. They're really bad people. They're a heist crew and they steal things and they kill people. And then by that time, they're like, well, it's been nice, but no, it took a while to find guys who would talk to me, but they did. And they were wonderful people, very vulnerable, very real. And some of them were kind of excited about the idea of bad firemen. But the people who are going to hate this book the most, I think, are firemen, and not so much for the badness of the characters, but for the leaps that I have taken with procedure and the baby out the window part. I really wanted that as a concept, and I kept saying to firefighters, if this happened and that happened and that happened, would you do this? And they'd all go, no. The first thing that they ever say is, that would never happen. And I go, yes, but we're on the fiction train now. Get on the train with me. The doors are open. We're going to fiction land. And they have to kind of unpick themselves from reality. And like, because they're not fictionally minded, you know? And that's so yeah, they're going to hate it. They're going to be reading it the whole time going, well, you wouldn't do that. Or you wouldn't put the ladder there. Well, you'd use the thingy. You'd do the thing. Too bad.
Whatever they think, it's great reading. Thanks so much for joining me on the Good Reading Podcast.
Oh, that's all right. My pleasure.
I've been talking to Candace Fox about her latest crime thriller, Devil's Kitchen. It's published by Penguin Random House, and you can find it at goodreadingmagazine.com.au. My name's Greg Dobbs, and thanks for listening. This Good Reading podcast was brought to you by Book People Gift Cards. Share the joy of reading with a Book People gift card. To find out more, visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.